Bit of a change to the agenda today, and it's just a kind of a technical thing. Originally, we had planned on just having a discussion on Senate File 898, but we've decided that we'll go ahead and I'll present Senate File 898, and then we'll adopt the delete all amendment and go ahead and have a discussion about that. And the reason for that is that then we can have the first engrossment available for Thursday, when we will again discuss the bill and entertain amendments to it. So procedurally, that's the way we'll do it. And at this point in time, I'll turn the committee over to Senator Howe.
Senator Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I'd like to present to the committee Senate File 898, which is a fixed guideway transit and rail project report requirement bill, and this will be our vehicle bill for our omnibus transportation finance bill as we proceed forward. What Senate File 898 is again a fixed guideway transit and rail reporting bill that will require any new rail projects within the metro area in the state of Minnesota to create a report that will inform the legislature as to all of the costs associated with the project. And this is a bill that has passed the Minnesota Senate on two separate occasions last session, and in particular Senate File 3501 passed the Senate on a 64-2 bipartisan vote. And what we are attempting to accomplish here is to have more clarity and transparency in our transit development systems in the state of Minnesota, in which we are clear when we're using state dollars, where those dollars are going to be spent, and how we will fund not just the pre-design and the efforts along that front, but also the construction costs of it, where that money will come from, whether it be federal, local, or state dollars. And equally as important, through this report, we want to have a better understanding of where the operation and maintenance money will come from, not just for 1 year, but for for 20 years of the operation and maintenance of that project. And really, the gist of it is to have a better understanding going forward of what the true costs are, and to be transparent. And I believe what it'll do is help us as legislators prioritize better the ongoing efforts to construct passenger rail, streetcar, and light rail projects in the state of Minnesota. It'll just offer more clarity. And, Mr. Chairman, I would like to move Senate File 898.
Senator Gimsey moves Senate File 898. Senator Gimsey. Because you'll want to Senator Gimsey. We're going to have to wait just a little bit. We need one more senator to arrive.
Well, and that's fine, Mr. Chairman. We would like to not act on that motion, but present the A1 amendment, delete all amendment, which is our omnibus finance bill.
Quorum is present for the record, and Senator Gimpsey moves the A1 amendment. Does everyone have a copy of the A1 amendment?
Yeah.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The A1 amendment is adopted.
Hey, Mr. Chairman and members, with me today I have Ms. Boyd and Ms. Berzovsky that will be going through the appropriation and finance bill. Ms. Boyd will be doing Article 1, I believe, and Ms. Berzovsky will go through Article 2.
Chair, Ms. Boyd, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, can you hear me okay? Okay. I'm going to be working off the actual amendment instead of the spreadsheet, but I will highlight any important details in the spreadsheet after I go through Article 1. So starting on Section 1 of Article 1, this is just a summary of all the appropriations in the bill specified by fund. The 12 and 13 total, fiscal year 12 and 13, is $4.69 billion to transportation-related programs and under Department of Transportation, Metropolitan Council, and Department of Public Safety. This is an increase of 7% over the previous biennium appropriations. Section 2 just lists the default fund in the bill, the Trunk Highway Fund, unless another fund is named, and specifies that any appropriations for fiscal year ending June 30th, 2011 are effective immediately. There is one of these appropriations in the bill. Section 3 starts the appropriations to the Department of Transportation. Subdivision 1 is simply the total appropriation specified by fund. Subdivision 2 is the multimodal systems section of MnDOT. The first section is aeronautics. This appropriation is a base appropriation. There's no change from the forecast amount or the base amount. So there were no change items in this area. Should I go through? Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I'm going to speak real briefly about the riders since we do have a lot of new members on the Transportation Committee. And if there are any questions, anyone can stop me. The first rider just specifies that it's from the State Airports Fund, and the section of statute it refers to lists just parameters on the use of the funds, any local contributions that need to be made according to the type of project, et cetera. The next rider says that the appropriation is available for 5 years after the appropriation and that the appropriations can be used between the years of the biennium. The third rider was new for the first time in our last budget bill and simply states that the commissioner, if the appropriation for either year from this section does not exhaust the fund balance in the State Airports Fund, that the commissioner may request to or may add the remainder of the fund balance to the appropriation and notify the legislature that that was done. On page 3, there's a small section on aviation support and services. This is mostly from the Airports Fund as well. There is no change to the base amounts here, no change items in this area. The next section is transit, Greater Minnesota Transit, operated by Department of Transportation. These appropriations represent a $4 million per year reduction from base forecasted amount. That reduction comes from the general fund portion of the appropriation. Let's see. The riders in this section, the first rider, it relates to the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access. The council was enacted in 2010. And this appropriation was made for the administrative expenses of the council. It comes from the base general fund appropriation. The next two riders deal with classifications of service under the public transit participation program, and it specifies that any changes to operating assistance for these public transit systems as a result of the reduction in the general fund appropriation, there are some parameters here that There are four classifications of service under Greater Minnesota Transit. There is urbanized, small urban, elderly and disabled, and rural systems. And this specifies that elderly and disabled service must not be less than the amount used in 2011 for that purpose. And the amount as operating assistance for rural area service must not be reduced more than 10% below 2011's figures. Moving on to freight, in paragraph C. Here in the general fund appropriation, there's a $49,000 reduction per year. This was part of the governor's recommendations. It is to reflect the elimination in 2010 of the hazardous materials registration program, which was seen as a redundant program. It's already done on the federal level. That was eliminated, and this is represents the administrative cost of that program, so that cut was made. Page 4, we start the state road section of MnDOT's appropriations. First is operations and maintenance. There's no change to this from the base numbers in this area. This is all trunk highway fund appropriation. The next section is program planning and delivery. There is an increase in the first year and a decrease in the second. No, I'm sorry, this section, there's increases in each year. And that increase is a small increase to reflect increased federal aid for planning and research purposes. There's an additional $800,000 in the fiscal year 12 figure and $615,000 in fiscal year 13. The first rider in this area deals with a targeted group business program. There's separate policy language in the Senate right now somewhere floating around. And this is a conditional appropriation that this $130,000 is appropriated from the Trunk Highway Fund in this section each year for the cost of this program if such a program is enacted. The next three riders are riders that are present in the last several budget bills, but I'll explain them briefly. Just the first rider, the $266,000 each year, are for MnDOT to make grants to MPOs, Metropolitan Planning Organizations, for any planning and delivery related to trunk highway projects outside the metro area. The next rider is $75,000 in each year from the Trunk Highway Appropriation to a transportation research contingent account. These are for research projects that federal funds reimburse. And the next rider is $600,000 each year for grants for transportation studies, outside the metro area, to identify critical concerns, problems, and issues. That's all I have to say about that. So, and on page 5, the next appropriation is for the State Road Construction Program. This is for the actual construction, reconstruction, and improvement of trunk highways. And the appropriations in each year are shown. The $881 million in fiscal year 12 is an increase from base. It includes $146 million increase in federal funds to reflect actual federal aid agreements coming into the fund for projects. And another $100 million comes out of the Trunk Highway Fund for appropriation to an economic development account within the Trunk Highway Fund. That rider you'll see at the bottom of the page. And that account is established in language in Article 2 of the bill, so we'll talk about that. In fiscal year 13, there's an $80 million reduction from the base amount, again representing a change in receipts of federal aid. And those changes end in fiscal year 13, so the first lines you'll see state what the base should be for the tails. And then there's just a breakdown of where these funds come from. The majority come from federal highway aid projected to be received by the department for projects, and the rest is from highway user tax distribution to the Trunk Highway Fund. On page 6, this is language that originated in the last biennium's budget bill, just stating that directing the commissioner to expend, but it's permissive up to 0.5% of the federal receipts under the section for job training programs related to highway construction. And the next rider says that the commissioner may transfer $15 million each year to the Transportation Revolving Loan Fund. These are loans made and paid back into the fund to political subdivisions, mostly local governments, for any costs that they might want on a trunk highway project. And then we move on to highway debt service. These are base amounts from the February 2011 forecast projected for outstanding debt service and outstanding trunk highway bonds. Each year also includes $14 million broken down as $4 million for the Transportation Revolving Loan Fund and $10 million for local advances on projects. There is a section of statute in which local governments can advance money to contribute to a project that they want in their area, and this money is going toward paying back the local advances. So $10 million a year from local advances, $4 million from Transportation Revolving Loan Fund, and the remainder, as you'll see in the first line of the rider, is for actual payment of trunk highway bonds and are transferred to the state bond fund. The last section is electronic communications. There are no change to these items from the base amounts. I should point out that the $3,000 each year, as spoken in the rider from the general fund, are to operate the Roosevelt Signal Tower for weather broadcasting Lake of the Woods. This amount used to be $9,000 and was subject to some unallotments in the last budget cycle. So the base amount now is $3,000 each year. Page 7 starts the local road section. County state aid and municipal state aid, these are base amounts. There's no change items in these areas. And then in paragraph C there, it just states that the money in these funds is openly appropriated to the commissioner. So this language just allows the commissioner to amend the appropriation in accordance with the actual fund balances, but they do have to notify the legislature if any of those changes are made. On page 8, appropriations for agency management. And under agency services, there is one change item related to the increased federal aid for planning and research purposes. There's $65,000 each year. This was a governor's recommendation as well, and that's on the trunk highway line of the appropriation. Buildings, there is no change to this item from base numbers. Subdivision 6 talks about transfers within MnDOT appropriations. It allows transfers within trunk highway appropriations and within state airport fund appropriations. Except that no transfer can be made from the state road construction appropriation or the debt service appropriation, and the transfers cannot be made between funds. And then any transfers made under the section must be, the commissioner must notify the legislature that these have been made. The next paragraph under that section on page 9, this is part of the flexible highway account under the 5% remainder off the top of the highway user tax distribution fund. This is at... the commissioner has authority to expend these funds in certain ways, and this is what the commissioner has requested, the department has requested of these funds, and we put them in our bill for transparency, basically. And it states that in fiscal year 12, they're recommending $1 million transfer from the highway account to the municipal turnback account, the municipal state aid street fund. That's for restoration of roads that have reverted to the local authority. And then the next part is $1.9 million in fiscal year 12 to the trunk highway fund. This is also for turnback purposes. This is for trunk highways that will be restored and then reverted back to the local road authority. And the remainder in each year will go to the county turnback account and the county state aid highway fund. And this is not, it says the remainder, it's not listed, but I'll give you numbers at this point if you would like. The remainder in each year is $38.16 million in fiscal year 12. For the county turnbacks, and $24.25 million in fiscal year 13. So that's the bulk of the transfers. Subdivision 7 is about the use of state road construction appropriations. It just gives some authority. It says basically that the money encumbered in a year but not spent can be spent in subsequent fiscal years if it was encumbered before the biennium, provided it's for the same project it was originally encumbered for. Subdivision 8 at the bottom of page 9 is contingent appropriation language. This language is particular to the transportation budget area. Was put into place in 2007, I believe. And it differs from standard Legislative Advisory Commission language in that in most cases this notification is just on an advisory basis to the LAC. Under this section it says that any, there's a list of certain receipts or uses of trunk highway money that have to be notified to the Legislative Advisory Commission, and that change has to be approved by 5 members of the 8 that are on the Legislative Advisory Commission. And it just details the uses of these funds. Subdivision 9 was holdover language also for my last budget bill, saying that no trunk highway funds may be made for personnel costs in the governor's office. This was put into counter some interagency agreements that the former governor had in place, just to specify that trunk highway funds should be used basically for trunk highway purposes. And that's the end of Department of Transportation. The bottom of page 10, we start with the appropriation of Metropolitan Council. You'll see it's $48.97 million in each year, and that's all general fund appropriation. This represents a reduction from base of $16 million in each year. And then it breaks down between bus transit and rail transit. The reduction comes entirely from the bus transit line, the $16 million a year. And then the riders under that section starting at 11.9. This is a rider reserving $140,000 of the appropriation in each year for transit service for disabled veterans. This is free service and was enacted in 2009. On 11-13, there's a rider allocating $80,700 each year for administrative expenses of the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access. This is analogous to the rider under the MnDOT transit section. And then there's some rider language directing the council to deploy the following strategies: to avoid transit service reductions and route elimination as a result of the general fund appropriation reduction. These are in order that the council shall utilize operating efficiencies, then shall impose fare increases calculated to increase revenue by $10 million in each year. And third, to exercise the authority granted to the council later on in section or in Article 2. And this is to transfer accounts or transfer amounts from the Livable Communities Funds and the Right-of-Way Acquisition Loan Fund. And we'll give you more detail on that a bit later. And further says that the council may require service reductions or route eliminations only after all three of these strategies have been deployed. At the top of page 12, you'll see the appropriation for rail operations. And this is unchanged from base. This is the same $5.174 million per year. And then we start in the Department of Public Safety. Just to briefly sum up, there are no change items in this area, but I'll run through the appropriations. This is the total appropriation by fund in Subdivision 1. Subdivision 2 starts admin and related services, broken down by Office of Communications, and then public safety support. The riders under public safety support are for benefits to public safety officers and their survivors. These are transfer amounts from the general fund portion of the appropriation. And then there's a third rider related to this on the top of page 13.3. That's a transfer from the general fund appropriation for soft body armor reimbursements. The next three riders deal with transfers between funds in the appropriation. This is to account for mostly compensation-related, some operating expenses that are able to be billed to three different funds. The Bain appropriation comes out of the Trunk Highway Fund, and then these amounts are transferred back into the Trunk Highway Fund to pay for those parts of the appropriations attributable to the General Fund and the Highway User Tax Fund. I know that's very confusing, so maybe questions on that one. And then on page 14, as part of admin, we have the technology and support service. Again, no change in that area. And then we start the state patrol appropriations, and no changes in these areas as well. They're just broken down into patrolling highways, which is the bulk of their appropriation. There are amounts for commercial vehicle enforcement from the Trunk Highway Fund. The capital security appropriation line is all general fund appropriation. No trunk highway money is appropriated to capital security. Top of page 15, there's a separate budget area that this was enacted 2 years ago, I believe. The Vehicle Crimes Unit. And this appropriation is from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. This is to investigate registration tax and motor vehicle sales tax liabilities that don't pay all taxes owed. And because those taxes will come back, registration tax monies will come back into the Highway User Tax Fund, motor vehicle sales tax revenues that are captured will come back to the Highway User Tax and a portion to transit. The appropriation was made out of the Highway User Tax Fund. And then this was also language that was in the last part, that a report is mandated by February 1st, 2015 to report on any revenues actually generated by the Vehicle Crimes Unit. And we have driver and vehicle services split out into vehicle services and driver services. The bulk of those appropriations are from the Special Revenue Fund. There's a vehicle services operating account and a driver services operating account in the Special Revenue Fund. All fees assessed by DVS are deposited back into those accounts and are used for actual operation of the division. And those amounts are openly appropriated in statute, but these are the spending authority limits that the legislature directs the division. And then two more small pieces under DPS are at the bottom of page 15, traffic safety appropriation. This is a small appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund used to leverage federal monies for these purposes. And then subdivision 6 is pipeline safety. It's from the pipeline safety account and special revenue fund, and is funded by fees assessed on pipeline operators. Subdivision 7 is just a repeat of the rider under MnDOT's section, saying that trunk highway funds may not be used to pay personnel costs in the governor's office. What you can't see is there used to be a section here called contingent accounts that was eliminated from the bill. It had $750,000 over the biennium from the airports fund, the trunk highway fund, and highway user tax fund to pay for any contingencies that may arise that could be paid out of these funds. I've been advised that those funds have not been used for at least the last 15 years. The decision was made to just remove the set-asides from the bill. Section 6 is tort claims, $600,000 in each year from the Trunk Highway Fund to pay for any tort claims made. And then the last part of Article 1 is the 2011 reduction that I mentioned earlier. It's from the 2011 appropriation in state road constructions budget. You'll see at the bottom of page 17 from the Trunk Highway Fund. And this is to reflect reduced federal aid agreement receipts in 2011 of $43 million.
All right. Okay. Members, I think we'll stop there for a minute. And if we have questions on Article 1 for Ms. Boyd or Senator Gimsey, members. Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a little clarification and page 4, line 10, the $266,000 for grants to the metropolitan planning organizations. Can you explain, give me an idea who they are, who some of them are?
Ms. Boyd, Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, if you'll indulge me for a minute, I can pull something out for you. I also would defer to anyone from MnDOT who would like to answer that question probably more thoroughly than I could.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Scott Peterson from MnDOT. Senator Perry, metropolitan planning organizations are organizations that are established in federal regulation to assist with the planning of transportation development in metropolitan areas. The organizations that receive this appropriation are in Moorhead, East Grand Forks, La Crescent, La Crosse, those are all metropolitan organizations, and Duluth. I think that's the That's the span of them. And then the Met Council is in the is the MPO or Metropolitan Planning Organization in the Twin Cities metro area, but it's my understanding they don't receive any appropriations or revenue from this appropriation.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, I just want to add that I do have a breakdown of those grants made for the last several fiscal years if you'd like me to get you a copy or a copy for the committee.
Please.
Senator Sharon.
Would you, thank you, Chair. Mr. Peterson, would you say again why these grants are going to those communities?
Mr. Peterson.
Specifically why they're being targeted for grants as opposed to others not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, because of their role in the planning for the use of transportation funds, basically, and so it's to support the activities that help MnDOT and local governments, frankly, decide where transportation investments are most effectively made. So, and Mr. Chairman, I might add, I think I forgot Rochester in my list before too. In St. Cloud.
Senator Sharon.
I guess I, anymore.
No.
And everybody else. And, so those that are outside the metro area that are not included in that are not involved, are they involved in some other kind of transportation planning, or why are they not involved in transportation planning?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, there are population thresholds that these areas have to meet in order to be classified as an MPO or a Metropolitan Planning Organization. And those are the areas in Minnesota that meet that threshold.
Other questions, members? Senator Perry.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. On page 11, I'm interested on line 13, 80,000, or the appropriation. Can you give me an idea? Is that money all for salaries? Is that where do those dollars end up?
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, it's for the administrative expenses of the council, and that actually the charge for the administration support is with MnDOT in their Office of Transit. That total $100,000 a year does include the cost of hiring a consultant to advise the council on their charge, and the rest would be any other just administrative support. I don't believe the department has hired another employee to deal with this. I think it is among existing staff, but they could clarify that.
Senator Perry.
Thank you. Page 12, the I'm curious, when you got to this part under public safety, you said everything has remained relatively the same, and I guess I'm trying to this $380,000 that we have each year for public safety officer benefits, has that gone up or down? Does it stay the same, or
Ms.
can you explain that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, you're correct in that these amounts and the riders have stayed the same for the last several budget cycles. I have seen the reports, and I've spoken to the budget people at DPS, and it's felt that these amounts are sufficient to cover what they intend to cover. Sometimes amounts will have to be transferred between years to cover the cash flow for the purposes, but that they are sufficient at this point.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Perry.
Thank you. Ms. Boyd, is there a savings account, or do they use all of this $380,000 each year, or have they developed a savings account, or what do they do with the money that's not used?
Ms. Boyd.
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, no, the amount would they could not carry forward the amount from biennium to biennium, so any amount not used would cancel back to the appropriating fund, the general fund.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Perry.
Would that also then be the same for the $1,367,000 just below that on line 30, that if it's not used, then it just cancels back? So we're not rolling this forward so they have a big savings account?
Ms. Boyd.
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, that's correct. that's the correct for the first three riders, that it cannot be carried forward to the next biennium.
Senator Perry.
So, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Boyd, do we keep track of what is used each year? I mean, do we know on an average what has been used? And if this, it appears that we leave this the same, whether in the one account on line 30 we only spend $500,000, but we leave it the same, we don't make any adjustments one way or the other?
Ms. Boyd?
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, that's correct. I can get reports to you, or we can have DPS testify to that effect. We can access the numbers, obviously, in the state accounting system, and I've looked at those. I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I don't want to speak out of turn, but it appears that we come close to using the appropriation in at least the first and third rider. And in the second rider, the actual claims made on this account are greater than the amount appropriated, so the claims made are prorated according to how much the actual appropriation is. So I don't believe that there's any of that money that is unused.
I just
Senator Perry.
And then on page 13, again, the same question would be for line 3 on the soft body armor. Is that a price that stays there, and if they use it, if they don't, then it comes back?
Ms. Boyd.
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, that's correct as well.
Okay, and then I just have one final one, Mr. Chair. On page 14, line 18, commercial vehicle enforcement. Can you just give us an idea of this is a totally different unit than our state patrol, is that correct?
Ms. Boyd.
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, it's contained within the state patrol. It's just one of the functions of the state patrol.
Senator Perry.
Ms. Boyd, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm getting at is have we taken duties away from the state patrol officers, or are these actually officers that outside of this commercial vehicle enforcement are patrolling the roads? Or I guess I'm trying to see, because I see some of the units have got the big Suburbans and that, and they say vehicle enforcement or commercial vehicle enforcement. So I'm wondering,
this is in your packet.
I'm just trying to get a clarity on this, and maybe the chief or somebody could help me out.
I see someone from the state patrol here.
Because it is a, you know, and I bring this up because it's a coffee shop talk when you're sitting back home and they go, how come we have this and then we have this one? Do they both do the same thing? So maybe.
Major, could you state your name?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kenner Cardivan Major with the State Patrol. Mr. Chairman, Senator Perry, the commercial vehicle section is a division within the State Patrol, just like any other geographical district or one of our units. But its functions are specialized toward regulating and enforcing and educating the industry and our citizens about commercial vehicle safety. So it's a very specialized unit, similar to what our aviation unit would be.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Major, then, can they do the same thing? I mean, would they respond to an accident? I mean, are they backup? I mean, I know I understand now they're specialized, but can they multitask in times of need, or how does that work?
Major Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perry, the inspectors and the troopers assigned to that division have very specialized training to deal with commercial vehicle inspections. They have to be certified in certain areas, and our other troopers don't have that type of training because it's very extensive and complex. So the unit has been separated. The other reason why that unit was separated a number of years ago was that we receive a safety grant, a primary safety grant from the USDOT to conduct certain safety activities. And that unit, the people in that unit are required to be trained in certain areas in order to exercise that grant. The troopers we have assigned geographically don't have that training.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Major, this unit is stationed throughout the state, or are they centrally located and they go out from, say, the metro area? Or how do you have this unit positioned throughout the state?
Major Eckhart, when you explain that, could you also maybe explain where if a trooper stops a commercial vehicle and they believe there's a violation of some equipment or an invalid, inappropriate, or outdated sticker, what would happen in that case?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Senator Perry, the district headquarters for that unit is in Mendota Heights, but the unit is the state is broken into six geographical regions, and the personnel that are in that division are scattered throughout the state. And, of course, a significant number of those folks are assigned to fixed scale sites as an I-94 near the Wisconsin border or I-94 near Moorhead. And we have a number of those fixed scale sites that we staff. And then we also have inspectors and troopers that are assigned on what we call mobile operations. For instance, if, and I know you have a law enforcement background, if you were to make a stop on a commercial vehicle and you wanted assistance in dealing with those regulations, one of our people would respond to assist you in dealing with that commercial vehicle. So we spend a great deal of time interacting with local law enforcement in other communities to deal with challenges with the commercial vehicle industry.
One final one.
Senator Perry.
Mr. Chair, and one final. Are they licensed peace officers then?
Major Eckhart.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perry, we have about 30 troopers in that division. They are licensed peace officers, and we have about 70 commercial vehicle inspectors. They are not licensed peace officers. They have limited authority under the statute to perform certain activities.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Boyd, I'm still kind of trying to get my arms around this a little bit as one of the rookies on the block here. Going back to Senator Perry's original question, page 12, we're talking about the public safety officer survivor benefits and the public safety officer's benefit accounts. Could you go into a little bit more detail for me about how those funds are dispersed, who manages those funds, and a little bit about the process that surrounds that?
Ms. Boyd.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, I would defer my answer to that to anyone who wants to represent from the Department of Public Safety.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. The way that these funds work, the first appropriation is $380,000, and that's the appropriation for survivor benefits in the event that an officer is killed. And so when an officer is killed in the line of duty, we reach out to that family and provide the benefits that are available under the statute to that family. The second appropriation, the $1,367,000 per year, that amount has stayed the same. That is back in, I believe it was 1997, the legislature directed local units of government to continue to pay health insurance benefits for police officers, and then later they added firefighters to that. So police officers and firefighters that are injured in the line of duty. And they set up an appropriation from the state to help, you know, offset some of the costs that the local units of government incur to provide that benefit. So we have this $1,367,000. We administer that through the commissioner's office, and cities and local cities apply for those funds and indicate the number of officers or firefighters that are injured in the line of duty. We basically every year divide the number of claims into the $1,367,000, and then that money is provided to the cities according to that prorate basis. Then the $508,000 that's for soft body armor reimbursement. We also get a grant. Local units of government also get a grant from the federal government to help offset the cost. So basically this is a match that is a state match that's paired with federal funds that agencies would have available, and then also the local agency itself would put some money towards soft body armor. So again, this is the number of we have $508,000, and when that $508,000 is gone each year, then we have to wait until July 1st, and then there's a new $508,000 that we have available to spend.
Thank you.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll go back to that $1.3 million that you were talking about, the benefits that are paid out. And I don't want to get deep into it, but is it for new injuries or issues, or is this something that goes on and on? I mean, so in other words, so if one year there were only, in this case, 25, you said you divided amongst those injured, or is that, and so I'm saying what I'm saying, if one year there's only 25 and you divide that amount of money, that's a larger payout as opposed if there were 150.
Ms. Ellison?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, the benefit is provided for an officer up to the point that the officer would turn 65 and be covered under Medicare. And so it is an ongoing benefit. And the officer has to usually the way, and again, we're getting a little into a little bit more detail than I have, but again, we get applications for officers or firefighters that are injured in the line of duty. Usually PARA, the Public Employment Retirement Association, is making the determination that this firefighter or officer is, in fact, disabled. And then we have a certain number of claims each year. Some of them maybe are holdover claims, some of them are new claims, and we just divide the number of claims into the $1,367,000 and allocate that out to cities. That's about as much accuracy as I have. There may be more details to it, but that's the
thank
way
you.
Members, other questions before we move on to Article 2? Seeing none, Senator Gempsey and Ms. Berezovsky, do you want to continue with Article 2, Transportation Development?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beginning on Article 2, which is on page 19 of the A1 amendment, Section 1 and Section 2 both come from the underlying Senate File 898 that Senator Gempsey presented at the beginning of this meeting. And those two sections bring in a cross-reference to the new language in Section 174.93. And what they say is that in Section 1, this has to do with state agency capital budget requests that are submitted to the legislature. And when they submit a request that has to do with a fixed guideway project, then they have to submit a financial plan that meets certain requirements that breaks down expenditures and funding sources, and breaking those down between committed and proposed sources, and also deals with operation and maintenance anticipated costs with again, committed and proposed funding sources for each guideway project. And Section 2 then applies those same kinds of requirements to capital project requests that come in from local units of government. Section 3 was Ms. Boyd referenced in her walkthrough of Article 1. This is a new account that is being created in the Trunk Highway Fund. It's the Trunk Highway Economic Development Account. And this is annually appropriated out to the Commissioner of Transportation, and it's to be used for economic development trunk highway projects, where that will promote economic development, increase employment, and relieve traffic congestion. The money in this account is to be divided 50-50 between the metro area and Greater Minnesota Transportation Districts. Section 4 is language that has been proposed by MnDOT, and it's parallel to language in Section 6 as well. Section 4 deals with the County State Aid Highway Fund, Section 6 with the Municipal State Aid Street Fund. And this changes the period during which the commissioner has to count actual receipts for the purpose of projecting the amount that will be available in those funds. The commissioner has to make a projection on December 15th of each year. And this would allow the commissioner to consider receipts from July through October rather than through November. And this was proposed by the department as an administrative efficiency. Then Section 5 is the text of Senate File 689, Chief Author Senator Gimsey, and this language modifies the eligibility requirement for a town that wishes to receive town road money from the county's town road account. The current law requires for eligibility that the town has to have levied a certain specified percentage of its taxable market value in the previous year. But the new language would say that a town is eligible if it levied at least as much as it had received from the town road account in the back previous year from that. And moving on to Section 7 on page 22 of the amendment, that is the first of four changes that have to do with the $1.75 technology surcharge that is imposed on various transactions that the Department of Public Safety oversees. And this $1.75 goes into the technology surcharge, the technology account that is paying for the development and ultimate operation of the MNLAR system. And these surcharges under current law are set to expire on June 30, 2012. And the bill extends that the collection of that surcharge to June 30, 2013. Section 8 is the first section of, I believe, three total sections that come from Senate File 478, Chief Author Senator DeCryf, and that is the initiative that was heard in this committee just a few days ago, and I believe it was recommended to pass on general orders yesterday. The Section 8 allows an eligible vehicle owner who is eligible for disability plates to obtain one motorcycle disability plate and one set of disability plates for another vehicle without having to obtain the approval of the Council on Disability. Under current law, the owner would just be able to get either one set of plates or a motorcycle plate without having to go to the Council on Disability for approval. And there are some other clarifying and conforming changes, a little bit of cleanup too in that section. Section 9 is the text of Senate File 179, which is Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill on eligibility for Gold Star special license plates. And that bill was heard in this committee and I believe sent on its way and also held for consideration for inclusion in this bill. And this just expands the eligibility for the Gold Star existing plates to legal guardians and siblings of a person who has died in service. Section 10 is the first section of Senator Senjum's Senate File 368, which was heard in this committee and heard in Finance Committee this morning. And that Section 10 increases filing fees for vehicle transactions by $1.50, changing the fee for registration renewals from $4.50 to $6, and for other vehicle transactions from $8.50 to $10. And the other part of that bill is a few sections down in this amendment. Section 11 is another change of the $1.75 expiration, the technology fee expiration. And that this is applicable to certificate of title transactions and or for duplicate certificates of title, and as well as originals. And this extends the expiration date from June 30, 2012 to June 30, 2013. Sections 12 and 13 are the rest of Senator DeCryf's Senate File 478. And these have to do with the disability certificate display on a motorcycle. The certificate has to be secured to the motorcycle under Section 12. And under Section 13, the commissioner has to design that certificate for a motorcycle so that it can be readily secured to the vehicle. Section 14 is the text as amended in this committee of Senate File 67, Senator Hoffman's initiative, that includes within the current $120 oversized annual permit for commercial boat hauling, the transportation of waterfront structures. And this section has an immediate effective date. Section 15, which begins on the bottom of page 30 and continues for a couple of pages in the amendment, is the next part of Senator Senjum's Senate File 368. It reduces driver's license and state ID card fees by $5, and it clarifies that the driver's license agent may collect and retain a $5 fee. So there's no actual change under this section to the fee paid by the applicant for the license or ID card. And there are also in this section two extensions of that technology surcharge expiration. Section 16 is the remainder of the underlying Senate File 898 having to do with guideway investment. And this, the existing language under this section was enacted in 2010. So this is a relatively new section. And then what this section would do is add additional requirements to the request to the legislature and to the report that has to come back to the legislature for capital projects. And I mentioned those before. They have to do with a breakdown of capital expenditures and funding sources for each guideway investment project, including committed and proposed sources of funds and breaking those out, as well as estimated operations and maintenance expenditures with a committed and proposed source breakdown. Then Section 17 is the last of the extensions of the expiration for the technology account. Then sections 18 and 19 authorize transfers out of certain funds for the Metropolitan Council to make to its transit operating budget in 12 and 13. Section 18 deals with the Metropolitan Livable Communities Fund, which has several accounts under it, and this authorizes up to 50% of revenues in the tax-based revitalization account, up to 50% in the Metropolitan Livable Communities Demonstration account, balances the balances in the Livable Communities Fund accounts. And then Section 19 is the Right-of-Way Acquisition Loan Fund, and the Metropolitan Council is authorized to transfer up to 75% of levied amounts for operating deficits for transit, paratransit, light rail, and commuter rail provided by the Council.
Thank you, Ms. Berezovsky. Members, questions on Article 2? Done a fantastic job. There's no questions.
They are good.
Seeing none, I think we'll move to the public testimony of this bill. Chris Bell.
You're doing just fine, sir.
How you all do that. Yeah. Listening to those numbers, my head is just buzz.
Take your time, Mr. Bell.
Thank you.
And state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chris Bell. And I am co-chair of the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities and the vice president of the American Council of the Blind of Minnesota. and I'm testifying on behalf of both of those organizations. Thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding the Omnibus Transportation Finance Bill. Many people with disabilities cannot or do not drive a motor vehicle. And I'm told, in fact, that 40% of Minnesotans do not or cannot drive a motor vehicle. Now, I'm blind, and I want to assure you that, generally speaking, I don't drive. And that if I do drive, I'll tell you where I'm going so you can get off the roads. Now, for people who are blind or severely visually impaired, which includes all of our members, the American Council of the Blind of Minnesota, we rely completely on public mass transportation. In the metro area, most of that is funded by the Metropolitan Council, as you know. Some of us, like myself, can't take a regular mass transit bus because of other disabilities. So we use paratransit, or in this area, Metro Mobility, or same-day premium taxi service. Many of our members do take the public bus system, whether this is to get to and from work, or for those people on public benefits who are not working, to be able to participate in social and economic activities. Safe and affordable public transit is absolutely essential for all of our members because, among other things, without it, we cannot work. Without it, we become more isolated, depend more on others, and ultimately end up taking public benefits. Now, there is another part of the disability community, and that is people who aren't yet disabled but will become disabled, because disability is an equal opportunity experience. And statistically, if you live to be 65 years of age, you have a 70% chance of developing a disability. Of course, not everybody with a disability can't drive. However, if you live long enough, you will reach a point when driving is not an option. In this regard, it's worth noting that the fastest growing demographic group in our society generally are those aged 85 through 100. I suspect some of those folks should not be driving. Take my father, for example. My father will be 89 this June, and he is still driving. This is not a good thing. He has corneal dystrophy, and his vision is quite poor. He can drive to local shops and businesses around his house, but if he has to go on busier streets, my stepmother has to say to him, "Herb, the light is red. You have to stop." I have had the occasion of being his only passenger, and that truly is the blind leading the blind, and quite scary. My father has no business driving, and I've told him this, and he responds that I'm fat. We're both right. The point is, if we don't adequately invest in public transit, people like my father will more likely continue to drive long after they are safely able to do so. Otherwise, their option is to stay at home and grow more isolated. Moreover, as the baby boom generation ages, we will have more and more Minnesotans who will need an alternative to driving their own motor vehicle. In our aging society, we need to invest in transit now in order to have the infrastructure ready for when the aging wave hits us. So where can we get the money from, given our tight budget situation? Well, the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities strongly believes that we need to focus on fixing the streets and highways that we currently have, rather than adding new highways and interchanges, which we cannot afford to maintain, particularly given we seem not to be able to afford to maintain our existing infrastructure. In fact, I attended one of the early committee hearings with representatives from MnDOT testifying, and I remember there were quite a few members of the committee who were upset about road safety and road repairs that hadn't been made. I think one of the highways listed was Highway 14, if I remember correctly. In the rural areas, outstate Minnesota, yesterday when I testified in the House Transportation Finance and Policy Committee, there was a gentleman that noted that just under, I guess, 2010 appropriations, MnDOT was meeting only 65% of the outstate needs, and that cuts would be extremely severe. So our view is to take what money we can save from building new highways and interchanges and apply that to repairing the infrastructure we have and building more mass transit, both for the needs of the people today and in the future. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Members, any questions for Mr. Bell? Mr. Bell, thank you very much for your testimony. We would now call Pat McCormick.
Thank you. Did you bring that stick? I guess
yes, you did.
Ms. McCormick.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pat McCormick, and I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And I just wanted to take some time. I know that initially the department and DVS had talked about our MNLARS project when we talked at one of our first meetings about the DPS budget and our business procedures. But I wanted to just respond to the amendment and the fact that in the amendment, the technology surcharge is extended for just 1 year. It'll be very difficult for DVS and the department to be able to negotiate a final contract with a vendor, with the selected vendor that we are currently negotiating with, if we can't demonstrate that we'll have the available funding in order to complete the project. And unfortunately, while I know that I was on record when we asked for this, requested this technology surcharge, that we thought we would be able to complete this project in a 4-year timeline, when we started working on our pre-design and re-scoped the project, it became clear that not only was there a lot more data cleanup involved, but as I had spoken about previously, we also realized that in order to even start phasing in the newly designed system, we would have to, first of all, complete almost all the hardware and software changes that will be needed in the new system in order to really start implementing any of the programs that would be part of our system. In addition to that, we also found out that our hosting costs, because we'll have to have two systems in operation, were almost twice what we thought they would be, as well as the fact that there are costs associated with us retiring our old system once we have the new system up. And so I just wanted to come up and explain those things to you. Also, just express again the fact that we do over 150 business functions on behalf of the state as part of our system, collect almost $1 billion in revenue for the state. We also interact with 75 business partners on a regular basis in order to do our work. And if our system fails and it isn't a fragile state, we certainly have been able to try to reinforce it to be able to make it during this design and implementation process. It's going to be very difficult. law enforcement won't have accurate records in terms of using, in terms of trying to enforce public safety. The Departments of Health and Human Services, Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources, the Secretary of State's Office, DEED, and the Department of Labor will not have accurate information, in addition to various federal agencies that depend on our information on a regular basis. And so I just wanted to make sure that I was providing you with the information you needed and also see if you had any additional questions that we could respond to.
Questions for Ms. McCormick? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Wes Kustra? Oh, Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chair, members, I just want to point out our thinking as we were putting together our budget. An extension of 1 year for the technology fee of $1.75 would bring us to the next budget cycle when we would be able to have a review again to ensure that the money was being spent and that we weren't collecting too much money. Rather than extending it out till 2015, we just simply thought that by reviewing that every budget cycle, make sure that they have certainly the money that they need to implement completely and fully the MNLAR system. We don't want to create any possible interruption to that process. And if it is the case that that could possibly happen, I'm more than willing to talk to the department about changing that date back again to 2015. I was unaware of that at the time, but it was simply a desire to review that fund and make sure that it was funded at an appropriate level that was not too high and not too high to meet the current need. So I can
thank you for that clarification, Senator Gimsey. I see Ms. Ellison has a comment. Ms. Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner. I just wanted to point out that state law indicates that we can't enter into a contract unless we have it fully funded. And so I appreciate the concerns that people have about the fee, and but I want to make it clear that we're currently in negotiations, and under state law, if we can't get the fee, we really should stop those negotiations until we know that we have the money to complete the project. The other contingency would be is if the legislature said, well, you can go ahead and negotiate this contract, but only have the contract last for as long as you know you have the funds. I can almost guarantee you that the vendor will come back after that first year and the price will have gone up to complete this project. So we're in a process of negotiating right now where we're in a really good position. And if we have to delay the negotiations or only negotiate for part of the project, I'm really concerned that the project cost will go up. So I just wanted that to be on the record as well.
Members, questions for Ms. Ellison? Ms. Ellison, can you tell me when was this fee or when did the program start? I mean, we heard testimony earlier that we didn't think we were going to need to go this long. Can you tell me when that?
Mr. Chair, we first started collecting the fee in 2009. And we originally thought that we would be able to complete this project by the end of it was either 2012 or 2013. I can't remember now off the top of my head. But when we, as Ms. McCormick testified, when we did the pre-design, it's sort of like when you reconstruct your house, you get in there and then you see that there are things that you didn't know you were going to have to fix, and the timeline and the price got longer and higher. And so that's why we came back and said we believe that we're going to need to have this fee for a longer period of time so we can complete this project. And so now we're in the process of negotiating with our selected vendor. We anticipate signing the contract by June 3rd, and it's for between now and the end of 2015. And so again, if we aren't going to have the funds to do it, we need to really step back and reassess the whole project. And I just want to point out that just issuing the RFP is a very, very complicated process and took many, many months. If we have to stop that process and do it again, we're probably talking at least 9 months a delay before we can move forward with the project.
Ms. Ellison, I hate to get bogged down too much in the details, but can you tell me how much money is available or how much money has been spent year to date, and how far off were the projections or the estimate on this process?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry to say that the estimates were far off. When, originally, we were told that we thought we could complete this for about $48 million. However, when we went through the pre-design and had to re-scope the project, now we believe the reasonable estimate is upwards of $65 million to complete the entire process. And also, because the hosting fees were more than what we thought they were going to be, and we are in a situation where we need to maintain the old system while we're installing the new system so that we don't have any interruption of providing services or collecting revenue. So there were many reasons why the timeline and the funding increased, but I'm going to ask Ms. McCormick to talk more about the money that's been collected and spent so far.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, so far to date, and this is about a month old, we had spent $7.2 million. And we had some money in about $1.7 million in encumbrances that still need to be paid out during this fiscal year. And we have approximately the MNLAR's account balance right now is $28,055,132.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any members' questions? All right, thank you very much. Wes Kustrom.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wes Koistra, and I'm the Director of Finance Administration at the Metropolitan Council. This bill reduces our metro area transit budget, reduces general fund appropriations by about $16 million a year, if I'm reading this correctly, and $32 million over the biennium. I want to mention that it's the governor's position that there are no reductions to the metro area transit. He said specifically that he wants to avoid fare increases in the metro area. And for that reason, we certainly need to speak in opposition to this bill. I want to also note that this bill requires us, in order to meet that reduction, to, of course, look at administrative reductions and efficiencies, which we do on an annual basis. I think the legislative auditor spoke that we are quite a well-run organization in comparison with other like transportation entities, but we will, of course, do that. We do that as part of our budgeting process every year. It also requires that we look at fare increases to the amount of $10 million per year prior to any service reductions, and then requires us to look at livable communities levies, Ralph levies, Tibber levies prior to service reductions. I will say that we appreciate Chair Gimsey's and the bill's emphasis that service reductions should be a last intervention, and we share that goal with him. I do want to mention that with respect to the fare increases, because we are required by federal law to have public hearings prior to service reductions or fare increases, we would not be able to implement a fare increase until midway through the first year of the biennium. This is somewhat technical but important. The bill says that we have to look at fare increases of $10 million per year. Even with a 50-cent fare increase, I don't know that in any recent history there's been over a quarter dollar fare increase imposed at one time. We would not be able to reach the $10 million amount in the first year of the biennium, just because we would not be able to apply that fare increase until the last 6 months. So there are some technical issues with how the fare increases is structured. For this committee's information, a 25-cent fare increase, which has been the typical increment that has been imposed, has a value of about $10 million for the biennium, not on a per year basis. And we typically, that comes in an increment of about $3 million in the first year and $7 million in the second year because of the delay. I also want to note that while I assume that the intent to avoid service reductions is an intent to avoid loss of ridership, fare increases do bring us a loss of ridership. A 25-cent fare increase typically, as we've seen in our models and experiences of past years, results in about a 2.6 million loss of ridership in a given year, or about a 3% loss. If we were looking at a 50-cent fare increase, the loss would be closer to between 5.5 and 6 million, because we lose more ridership as a larger fare increase is applied. So there is an unavoidable loss of ridership with a fare increase. Typically, some of that ridership recovers over the coming months after the initial fare increase is applied. I also want, for the committee's information, to point out that the use of livable communities funds was in the bill last year that expired in 2011. This use of our levies to fill the gap in the transit budget was first imposed at a time when we had a low demand for livable communities money and low demand for these grants because the economy was down. Now we're seeing the economy pick up, and we're seeing the demand for these grants to come back to levels that we had experienced before. So it's a little bit of a different situation imposing this mechanism from what it was when it was initially imposed last biennium. So with that, I can take any questions from the members.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about the balances that are currently in those two funds and what those funds are specifically used for.
Mr. Cusio.
Livable communities funds are used for economic development projects. It can be both in terms of supporting new business and supporting affordable housing. There's a lot of these projects that are transit-oriented development that are used in that, and the TIB account, the tax base revitalization account, is used for brownfield cleanup and then redevelopment by cities. So they would apply for grants as they had these types of properties available for cleanup and where they have likely development opportunities, and we would provide grants on that behalf. The highway right-of-way or the RALF fund is used as loans to cities to acquire properties that are in areas where there is plans for a need for highway right-of-way according to the highway planning and other transportation-related planning. So as properties become available and plans were in place for the need for those properties eventually down the road to support highway right-of-way, cities would apply for loans. And this money is distributed as loans to cities. In terms of the balances, I don't have that available to me at this time. I can get that information to the committee.
Thank you,
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. May I ask a couple of questions?
Certainly.
The transit system that you're describing does it have a mobility transit component to it, and are your transit systems handicap accessible?
Mr. Cusio.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, we do support Metro Mobility as part of our transit system for disability services. We also support Dial-A-Ride services as well in the outer areas of the Metro region. I believe most of our bus services, all our bus services are handicapped accessible.
Thank you. That just is the backdrop for a related issue when we cut transit services that we're talking about, which is trying to contain some of the costs related to special transportation services that are paid for out of the Health and Human Services budget. One of the issues there for the committee that do not know, there's a great deal of effort to move people off of special transportation services, which are
a more highly licensed van service, and moving people off of that onto access transportation, which is the mobility bus, which is the buses that are handicap accessible, because those who are eligible for that, medical assistance, have a disability, may have some limitations in terms of transportation, but are able to get there themselves and are directed to the transit system for those rides. One of the issues here in the metro area, as well as in the rural area, is, and even more in the rural area, we'll be talking about that, I assume, is the limitation of alternative transit services to STS, the less expensive service. So reductions to this kind of service, whether in the metro area or in the rural area, highly threaten our capacity to provide special medical transportation services for disability community.
Any other questions for the witness? Thank you, Mr. Cuso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Tony Kellen, please. Mr. Kellen, state your name for the record.
My name is Tony Kellen. I am the Director of Operations and Technology at Metrobus. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here today representing St. Cloud Metrobus. We're a transit authority. We're one of the three transit authorities in the state. Our authority provides transportation services in the communities of St. Cloud, Sauk Rapids, Waite Park, and Sartell, Minnesota. I'm also here today as president of the Minnesota Public Transit Association. I've served as president for the last 5 years for this association that was created in 1975. We represent transit systems throughout Minnesota. Many of those systems aren't able to make it to these hearings because they, in rural Minnesota and the rural small cities, they're the dispatchers, they're the office manager, there's a financial manager, they do pretty much everything. I'm testifying today in opposition to the level of the cuts that are being proposed both for the metropolitan area transit systems and the Greater Minnesota Transit. And for Greater Minnesota, especially the manner in which the cuts are being imposed. Today, I want to speak specifically about four major components of Greater Minnesota Transit and the impacts of the legislation. In the rural transit program, there are 40 systems. In the small urban systems, there are 13 small communities, one larger community, Mankato. In the urban systems, by definition, there are six urbanized areas: Duluth, St. Cloud, Moorhead, and Rochester, and then also East Grand Forks and La Crescent, La Crosse are, by federal definition, large urbanized areas. The elderly and handicapped programs that you read about in the draft language are really the programs that are contained within the five large urbanized area: St. Cloud, Duluth, Rochester, and St. Cloud. In 2010, there were 11 million passenger trips provided in rural Minnesota. Just under 25% of those were transported in the rural areas in those 40 systems. 9% of the trips, or just under a million trips, were produced in those 13 small communities. 65% of all the ridership in Greater Minnesota was in the four major urban areas, and to a lesser extent, a small amount in the other two areas. 2% of the service is of the elderly and handicapped type services, again in the larger urban areas. In 2001 and in 2010, in the update of the Greater Minnesota Transit plans, we continue to identify that we're meeting about 60 to 65% of the transit need. I'm not here to debate whether there's a need or not, or how you define need, but what I will say is that in the rural areas, it's our contention, and from what we experience on a daily basis with operating, and the folks that I talk to in those 40 systems, we're still not serving all counties. We're still not serving all the trips that people need. Many systems don't provide any service after 5 or 6 p.m. in the evening. Many systems don't provide any weekend service. If you're disabled in a non-urbanized area in Greater Minnesota, your ability to ride the bus is dependent 100% on the availability of service or non-availability of service. In some cases, if the bus is full or the ride is already booked, you may wait a week or 2 weeks for a doctor's appointment because there's just not the same level of service that you have in the metropolitan or the urbanized areas. For many of the elderly in Greater Minnesota, transit is the last line of defense to stay in their homes. In my hometown of Wheaton in Traverse County, there is a high number of housing units that are sitting empty, not paying any tax. For many elderly and seniors and for the disabled, transit in Greater Minnesota is the only opportunity for a doctor visit, a dental visit, or a pharmacy trip, groceries, and for that matter, any social interaction at all. I believe, and I've believed this for a long time after my 27 years in transit, that it's a very short-sighted view to assume that there will not be impact from cuts to transit. I would submit to you that transit general fund expenditures are a very good value for the dollars that the state expends. And I believe it's a modest investment to save the state dollars in other areas such as health and human services. There's maybe less of a distinction with the small urban systems and the rural systems, but they all serve the same type of needs, the same type of activities that you and I do when we get in our car and drive. They go to the grocery store, they go to the doctor, they go to work. Their trips are no different. It's just that they maybe lack a car or the financial or economic means to get where they need to go. And so the service in the small cities, the small what are classified as small urban cities like Benson, Faribault, Granite Falls, Hibbing, Le Sueur, Montevideo, Morris, Northfield, St. Peter, Stuartville, Winona, and a substantial system in Mankato are much like the rural systems. Urban systems have many similarities. Moorhead, with just over 400,000 passengers.
Mr. Kellen.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Kellen, we're at the end of our testimony time here. You were added as a courtesy onto the list. If you want to say your final comments, otherwise you're certainly welcome to come back on Thursday because we're going to hear more testimony on Thursday. So I'd ask you to conclude if you could.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, I don't have more than probably five more minutes, if it's okay with the committee, if I could finish. I did drive from St. Cloud.
All right. All right, go ahead,
thank
Mr.
You for
Keller.
Thank you for your consideration. I'll try to cut to the chase, I guess. Talk a lot about what transit is doing in the urbanized areas, and that was one of the focuses that I wanted to bring to you is that fully more than half of the dollars that are expended are in the urbanized areas. And we, as I said, transport over 65% of the passengers in Greater Minnesota. The language that talks about no cuts to the disabled and elderly program, that's great. That has an impact on us. The fact that you're asking not to cut more than 10% from rural transit does have an impact. Because what you're really saying is you're saying you want to reduce the funding of the general fund by $4 million a year, and you want to do that on the small urbans and the urban systems. The small systems and the urban systems in those areas already consume 46% of the general fund. So you're asking us to cut pretty much 100% of our general fund contribution in the systems in the urban areas by trying to hold harmless the elderly and disabled programs and limit the cuts to the transit programs in the rural areas. And I guess I would submit to you that MnDOT needs all the tools that they have available in their toolbox to be able to work with the different funding streams and to work with the different rising and falling levels of funds that are available. So I just think it's a bad idea to try to pick winners and losers, and I think it's better left to the agency. And I will say on behalf of the association that we believe that the agency does a fair job of allocating those dollars in the way that they do. And I also want to leave you with another consideration, too. The urban areas are the most efficient in cost per passenger, in cost per mile, in cost per hour. We are already contributing a great deal of service. In St. Cloud, of the service or of the urban areas, of the 308,000 hours of service that are provided, 55,000 hours are provided 100% local cost. So there's no state participation in 18% of the service in the urbanized areas as it is. St. Cloud contributes 35% of the total cost of the service on the fare box, taxpayers, and auxiliary revenues like advertising and so forth. Rochester is 40. Duluth is just over 30. Moorhead I'm not sure about. But, again, I think that we realize that cuts are coming, but let's not try to dictate the winners and losers. Let's let the system work that's in place to handle that. Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Just I really appreciate the comments that are being made, and I wonder if we could request to have, it looks as though the comments are in writing. Could we have a copy distributed to all of us of your comments to be able to absorb it a little more comprehensively. And then I'd also ask the chair, I saw that Mr. Peters from the Department of Transportation left. I meant to ask him, it apparently is in the legislation that the distribution of these cuts to the rural transit providers would be determined through the Department of Transportation, and I would like to know if these cuts are retained, just exactly how they would distribute those costs among those systems.
Senator Sharon, I would certainly, I'm sure Mr. Peterson will be here on Thursday, and Mr. Callen, would you be willing to provide those comments or those written comments if we can give them to staff, we can get them photocopied for you?
I'd like to just clean up my notes and give it to you.
You can just provide them to us.
Yes.
All right, thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Callen? Thank you, Mr. Callen. Any further discussion on Senate File 898? Hearing no discussion, that will conclude our walkthrough today of 898. Senator Gimsey, what would you like to do with this bill?
Mr. Chair, I would like to withdraw my motion, first of all, and lay it over till Thursday when we will entertain amendments to the bill and continue our discussion of it.
Any objections to that, members?
But just briefly, Senator. Mr. Chair, before you adjourn us, I would like to say how we, some of the strategy behind how we came to the way we appropriated or the reductions in spending in transit.
Senator
Gibson. Had we taken a look at total ridership, the Met Council would have received a lot greater share of the reductions in the general fund expenditures. Our target was $40 million and but we didn't look at it that way. We looked at what options each of the different levels of transit in the state of Minnesota have, and clearly the Met Council has a lot more options as far as how they can adjust and move in their operations compared to the small operations out in rural Minnesota. And so our sensitivity really was to the increased number of miles that these transit operations must make to get the elderly to where they need to go and to give them the level of service, to maintain the level of service. You know, and our urban providers, they have even more options than the rural do, and in fare box recovery and in local tax base to support these operations. And so that was the thinking behind how we allocated the reductions that we were targeted to reduce. And it wasn't based on any other motivations or animosities toward anybody, but just in taking an approach in which these different transit authorities have options to mitigate the reductions. So I just thought I would give a bit of a perspective as to how we approached the reductions that we were targeted to reduce. So
Thank you, Senator Gimsey. Senator Gimsey withdraws his motion on Senate File 898.
Oh, I just want to ask a quick question.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I just have to ask to do my due diligence. Even though Chair Gimsey, we are not the other body. The other body significantly revamped its bill between the walkthrough and then the actual hearing with the amendments and the like. We don't anticipate that here, do we? We're going to be working off this bill.
Mr. Gimsey, or Senator Gimsey, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I don't anticipate that. I am very familiar with the adjustments that the House made to their bill, but we are not the House. We are the Senate, and we will move forward in an appropriate manner here.
Good.
Any other discussion? Members, just a reminder, we'll be taking amendments on Senate File 898 on Thursday. For those wishing to have amendments drafted, it would be appreciated if you would contact Bonnie Brzozowski or the Revisor's Office by the end of the day tomorrow to get your request in. There being no further business before this body, this meeting is adjourned.